motherfuckers gonna have the news.
It's Monday, October 7th, 2019. Hayes Davenport, Scott Frazier, LA Podcast. Alyssa Walker is out of town. This is a throwback episode. It was a pretty quiet week.
Yes, if you were not in Washington, D.C., yeah. I suppose.
This is an issue I'm finding with our... You can see in our listen stats,
yeah,
if it's like a big impeachment week, we take a little bit of a hit.
Well, that's people really, that's say, on us, right?
I guess so, for not manufacturing enough local news.
I mean, we could also blow the whistle on something, right?
Surely. I've been just keeping my whistle in my pocket, but I gotta get those listens up. But we have plenty of stuff to talk about this week and sort of some broader stories that we want to get into. Would you like to start with an LA story? You were a volunteer at Ciclovia today. Did you have any stories to tell from that?
This is the weekend for the Heart of the City Ciclovia route, which goes through downtown LA. Ton of fun. I volunteered. Someone at my work actually set up for a bunch of us to adopt an intersection, which is something that they Ciclovia, they close down streets to car traffic, all motorized traffic, and then they have a couple of intersections where cars pass through, so all the bikes and everybody walking and everything, they stop at those intersections. So mostly it was just helping people, making sure people were coming to a stop, making sure that people knew where the route went, and getting them directions and things like that if they needed it. It was really cool. I was just posted in Chinatown for like 3 hours today and saw probably like 5,000 to 10,000 people go past the point where I was.
Yeah.
And yeah, you really just get a sense of the cross section of LA that is taking part in these events. And that was actually the first one that I had been to in several years. I think the last one I went to was there was one that they did on King in South LA. I don't remember when it was. I think it was like 4 years ago, maybe. Okay. That was probably the last one I was at. Have you been to a Ciclovia recently?
Not recently, no.
Right? Yeah, it's been a little bit off my radar. So I was happy to, even though I wasn't really participating, I was happy to like go out there and just see everybody with, God, I saw a lot of little dog bassinets. That's a special...
Like a little like bike basket for little dogs?
It does almost seem like it was made for a baby. And they just put
those trailers that are like little tents that you can't see inside, but it's probably like 50-50 chance that it's like a child or a dog in there.
A lot of like little parasols set up in those baskets as well. People were very creative. I saw several Darth Vader-esque get-ups. It was fun.
That's nice. No injuries. You didn't have to do any.
I did see a wipeout. No, I did not.
One wipeout.
I did not have to do any triage. I did see one wipeout, and the person seemed like they were okay. They got back up and were on their way.
Today, I went to Lithuania Days at Little Lithuania in Los Feliz, which is basically one parking lot near Gelson's on Hyperion. It's the whole festival is a testament to the power of the potato. I had potato pudding, potato cake, some kind of beet soup that also had potatoes in it.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, they worked it in.
And I watched some traditional dancing.
Uh-huh.
This is the second year in a row I've gone. That was fun. I have a Sila story that I'm only telling because I realized it was the kind of thing that would be in a very bad movie. It was like kind of thing that you see in a movie and be like, this is so contrived.
Right.
Why did somebody write this? But this actually did happen. Yesterday, I was driving the van for Sila, the homeless services nonprofit that I work for. And we go pick people up in different encampments around the area and drive them back to get showers and case management and food and clothes and stuff at this church that rents us the property. And I was picking some people up at Hoover and Temple, which I don't know if you've been through there recently, that it's an encampment that has grown like really, really huge. It's like enormous.
No, I don't think I've seen that one.
It's near like Cafecito, Organico.
Sure. Under the 101.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And we picked some people up there, and it was a couple, and they were both like pretty non-communicative and weren't like in great shape. And so we brought them back, and they didn't talk too much. And then they took a shower, and then we were bringing them back to their encampment. And the guy I was driving with was trying to argue with me about the movie Prometheus. The guy, the guy who was in the passenger seat, like another volunteer.
trying to argue like you didn't want to talk about Prometheus.
I was not really
Prometheus.
Interested in defending the movie Prometheus, which I liked.
Okay.
And I've heard a lot of people like trash it over the years, but I thought it was quite good.
Uh-huh.
And
so he's saying, was the last straw.
Yes. And he's saying like it sucked. Like everyone in it acts so stupidly and like there's no explanation for their behavior and all this. And then the woman in the back says, Prometheus is a great movie. The first thing she has said, and she proceeds to fully sun this dude. And with, she says, like, they don't, like, make it obvious what the story of the movie is, but they leave these clues that are really interesting that you can put together that, like, kind of tell the story of how humanity and the xenomorphs, the aliens, were created. And like she says, like, and the reason, like, you know, with like if their behavior is like inexplicable, that's why it's a movie. Like they put themselves in like intense situations so you can enjoy like a movie.
Right. Instead of having to watch a thing
yeah,
where everybody makes sensible decisions.
Yeah, would you just prefer nothing happen? And it was so amazing and funny to watch this. I, of course, like the guy who's voluntary, but it was very funny to watch him just get fully destroyed by this person who totally had not spoken up to that point. But I realized, like, I've seen that kind of thing in movies all the time where they do the, like, they're just like us thing. And, yes. You're like, this is so corny.
Right.
But that was something that happened to me yesterday that I have no other outlet for except for this show.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I was thinking about the article that came out, I think it was maybe an op-ed came out in the LA Times like last week or 2 weeks ago that was about how the homeless have been feeling more afraid for their safety. And it was like, there was a poll quote from it where somebody was talking about that they like sleep with a knife in their tent now. And I just thinking as you were talking about that encampment growing, I was actually like walking the other day and I saw a guy who like in his tent, like had a knife just like under his pillow. And I was like thinking about, all the like rhetoric that we've been talking about recently about how like every encampment is a danger to house people and how we just like know that that's not the truth. But like it just is, if that's like the messaging that's coming out of City Hall, I feel like it makes so much sense that you have to defend yourself. Like,
yeah,
there doesn't seem to be any help coming from the city at this point.
Right.
I was very surprised to see, I don't think I've ever really seen anything like that. It just sort of happened right after I read this article in the LA Times.
The man in this couple had a knife and there's always the thing like, oh, what do we say? Like, we can't have him like bring the knife in the van and stuff. But you just ask and say like, hey, we'll hang on to that and we'll give it back to you at the end. And
they
like always just hand it over and it's not an issue. But yeah, I was out with a group of people yesterday and they were talking about the four people in New York who had just been beaten to death in a homeless encampment. And somebody said, no, this was today actually. And somebody said, but I heard it was another homeless person, as in like,
it's not our problem.
Well, that was sort of implied, but also like, it's not about the conflict between housed and unhoused people. And so you just seemingly kind of have to shrug and like, that's how it goes. But to me, I mean, it's like it just underscores that all the danger of homelessness falls on people who are homeless. We think about it as a threat to housed people, but
certainly,
like the people who are homeless are the ones who are in danger.
I think that that's the, okay. So that is exactly my experience, that like even in Skid Row, which is, of course, like a very telling symptom of the homelessness crisis in LA specifically. And it has been over time for a long time. But like, I feel like when violence happens in Skid Row, there is like this mentality among Angelenos of like, that's where violence involving homelessness happens. Like that's where it belongs, basically.
Exactly.
And as
like,
long as
you
have
to be careful going through there because someone might attack you. And it's like, no, the victims of this are the people who live on the street. The vast, vast majority of them. A lot of presidential candidates coming through town.
Yang gang.
It is weird getting all this attention. We are not used to it. Elizabeth Warren was here. She got the endorsement of Lorena Gonzalez from the California State Assembly, who just got AB 5 passed and signed by Gavin Newsom. normally the endorsement of a California state assembly member would not mean shit to any presidential candidate. But now that California elects their primary candidate on Super Tuesday,
yeah,
people are coming through and not just asking for money. They're asking for votes.
Yep.
What was some of the stuff that happened this week?
So we had several articles come out this past week about, as you mentioned, presidential candidates who were visiting. Warren took a swing through California, culminating with a giant rally in San Diego. She also stopped in LA and had a meeting with members of the advocacy group CHRLA, the Immigrants' Rights Coalition that we've spoken about a number of times on this show. Andrew Yang had a large rally at MacArthur Park. And there's also been some talk about Kamala Harris, who, of course, came out of California as attorney general and then and now currently senator before deciding to run for the presidency. Harris has had the backing of a lot of elected officials, in particular in the Democratic Party, but she's been struggling and falling behind in polling in California. So the LA Times had a story about that as well, spoke with a number of people in Los Angeles in particular who were basically like, she just as a candidate isn't catching on the way that people kind of expected that she would when she had her high profile launch in Oakland. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're seeing a lot of interest in a way that if you remember previous cycles, it just didn't happen. California did not attract presidential candidates who were out here actually trying to convince people to vote for them.
Yeah.
And of course, Lorena Gonzalez, her endorsement of Warren follows Warren's endorsement of AB5.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly thereafter, Lorena Gonzalez endorsed her and introduced her at this rally. So her profile as an assembly member who would endorse a presidential candidate, particularly among progressive Democrats in California, does mean something. Whereas I think you have probably 70 other assembly members whose endorsement would not get a whole lot of notice on right. the national stage.
Yes.
But yeah, we're it's October. We've got a couple of months to go before the primaries actually take place, and presidential candidates are lining up to come through here.
Yeah. They're also asking for money while they're here. All I really have access to is like sometimes getting invited to backyard fundraisers for like different candidates. It's still, I don't think I've been invited to a single Warren event, definitely not a Sanders event, no Biden events. It's pretty much all Harris and Buttigieg.
Interesting.
In
Buttigieg.
Almost equal numbers.
Okay. Well, they're polling at about the same.
So I was looking at the LA Times map of LA zip codes. In each LA zip code, they say which Democratic candidate raised the most money.
Right.
They show exactly how much they all raised in each zip code. So, Scott, I'm going to give you a zip code.
Okay.
And you are going to guess which Democratic candidate raised the most money in that zip code based on the last quarter, not the one that just got reported, the last SEC filing that all the data has actually come out for. We don't have the most recent data yet.
Got it.
So let's start with 90210. Guess which Democratic candidate raised the most money in that district.
90210.
$188,588, about double the next person who you can also guess.
I am going to guess that is a Harris.
That is a Harris
zip code.
Number two, 99,000.
Number two candidate, Buttigieg?
Correct.
Wow.
Harris, Buttigieg, Biden at 90,000. Huge gap. Warren, 15,900.
Oh, that is a big
gap. Sanders, 11,000.
Okay.
Massive
Harris
desert.
Who are the fucking Pinkos in Beverly Hills?
Okay, let's go down to 90037. It covers USC. It goes through like South LA.
Okay.
Like Vermont Square. Like it's the 110, like down to Slauson, basically between Expo Park and Slauson.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. Who is.
What is the total amount for this?
The total amount for number one is $2,954.
Oh, wow. That feels like that could be anything.
And it's well ahead of number two.
Of number two. Yep. Okay. Is this a Warren?
Warren is fifth.
Whew.
With $134.
Okay. It's like $3,000 for an entire zip code.
Yep.
Is hard.
Yeah. But it's a far and away lead.
Biden.
It is Sanders.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Go Sanders, Buttigieg, Harris.
Oh, you said it contained USC.
Biden raised $53 in this district.
Good.
He is sixth. And by the way, there is no Biden zip code.
There is no Biden zip code.
On the, oh, no, I'm sorry. 90005.
A-Town.
Yep.
That's one of the ones that's like not even a real geography. It's like,
it's like a bizarre office strip building. And it is actually like single lots, like they're islands within 90005. It's a very, very weird one that runs kind of along 8th Street. But that is the Biden district. Let's go up to this part of town, and 90026 covers like kind of the bottom half of Silver Lake. And then goes down to
Echo Park.
Echo Park and like Temple and like Rampart and like that area.
90026. Where, if I were a Silver Lake fat cat, like my dear friend hates that report. What is the total?
51,893. Okay. Pretty significantly ahead of the next one, which is 43,000.
I'm going to try Warren again.
This one is Sanders.
Okay.
It goes Sanders, Buttigieg, Harris, Warren. They're all a little closer together. Warren is 25,000.
Hit me with somewhere in the valley. I'm bad at this game, by the way.
Let's do... Say, like, pick an area.
Arleta, next to Pacoima.
Okay. Number one is $2,351.
This is 91331.
This is 91331.
I want to go Sanders.
It is Sanders.
Okay, so it's the small dollar.
Wait, how much did I say it was?
$3,000?
No, it's $5,174. Yeah, Sanders is number one. Most of the valley is Sanders territory.
Wow.
Until you get over into Porter Ranch and Chatsworth, and then it becomes guess who?
Harris?
That's right.
I'm interested to see how this changes over the course, because these are still such small amount. This is... quarter two, so going through the end of June, I guess.
Yes.
I'm very interested to see how this changes as we get closer to the primaries and then after the primaries.
Yes.
But that is, imagine saying that San Fernando Valley would be Sanders country, you know, like a generation ago or whatever.
Right.
It's incredible.
Right.
Really, really massive change.
And even like huge neighborhoods like downtown adjacent, like basically downtown is a Harris Island surrounded by Sanders. But I think what we'll start to see change is Warren has been raising a ton more money. Some of these areas could sort of flip to her. Right now, her only zip codes are Glendale, part of like La Cañada, Flint Ridge, and Topanga, one big one, 90290, like near like Pacific Palisades, kind of.
And it's harder because, I mean, we willingly surround ourselves with the most intentionally miserable people on the planet on Twitter, but this is like too early for most people to actually be paying attention to, like, and funding the presidential race at this point,
yes.
Right? It's a self-selecting group.
Yes. This map is fun to play with. You go to the LA Times 2020 Democrat campaign donors map, just Google that and just have a good time. Boy, a lot of complaining about pickups at LAX this week. I saw Unified complaining about how Lyft and Uber will no longer be allowed to do curbside pickups at LAX. This is a service I have never used. Huh? I don't really understand how it would work. I mean, I guess you just call for Lyft or Uber and they're waiting in a lot, or they're already driving around?
Typically speaking, they are waiting in a lot. I believe that they have to be.
Okay.
And they come through the horseshoe. It takes forever.
Yes.
But it, so does everything going through the horseshoe.
But the cab is right there. Like, often there's like a cab waiting in the line for you. It's not that much more expensive.
Yeah. I think at this point, there is sort of like a market segregation where you have people like myself who don't even remember what it was like to order a cab.
Right.
That just like opt for the ride hailing because it was familiar.
Sure.
But yeah, so Lyft and Uber no longer going to be allowed to do their pickups. They were on the, I feel like they were on the departure level. They were on the top. So like there would just be enormous lines waiting for those pickups, enormous lines of cars trying to pick people up. It was always a mess. I have used this service personally, but I'm not part of the hubbub that is like surrounding this decision. What actually prompted this change? Do we have a...
I assume it was chaos. Just like every experience anyone's ever had at LAX over the last like couple of years.
I know, but it's still, it's kind of interesting because...
Yeah, you feel like it must be something else.
Like LAWA, LA World Airports is not like famous for its responsiveness to feedback about the experience of traveling through LAX.
Well, the LAX brochure about the new lot, this is reported by Bianca Berrigan and Curbed, says, we are being proactive in protecting our guests and neighbors from traffic that is bad and getting worse. Huh. And their Twitter account said that the move is expected to eliminate 15% of the cars.
That is wild.
That's a lot. I saw Mike Lenz, who's guested on the show, talk about having to sprint to the airport, just get out of his car and run. I've absolutely had to do that before. Yeah, I mean... And so they're all going to be in a lot called LA Exit, which I saw other people making fun of, and I think is good. So you take a shuttle to the lot, or you can walk from like the actual airport, which takes about 15. The shuttle takes about 15 minutes, and a walk is about the same time.
I will say I have never once in all of the times that I have actually requested a Lyft or whatever from LAX, it has never once taken less than 15 minutes for the car to actually pick me up.
Yeah.
Generally like 25,
right.
I would say.
Yeah. And then I assume then you won't have to wait as long to get out.
Right. Yeah. It's a mess. But it is interesting though. So 15% of the traffic in the central terminal area is from Lyft and Ubers. That is wild when you consider the fact that they were not even permitted by the city to go into that area until what, like 2016?
Was it that late? I was going to say like 2014 or something like that.
It was a while after they became popular services. Yeah. So it's really only been a couple of years. And that's a significant worsening of the traffic situation there.
But it feels like that checks out to me. It does feel worse than it has ever been in the 10 years that I've lived here.
Yeah,
it's
I
profoundly worse in the last couple of years.
I completely agree. And so like also we have other... Our co-host Alyssa made a very good point about all of the other services that have to make use of shuttles, and that Lyft and Uber were being granted a very generous exception in allowing all of these private automobiles to come into the terminal area. It is a different approach than we've seen at other airports nationwide. Chicago famously put in place a tax on private Lyft and Uber drivers coming into that was just a tax on top of the rideshare fare. And that was intended to raise money for their transit system. So this is definitely a different alternative to that. Mm-hmm. But we are also approaching the 2024 date that we're supposed to have the people mover out of the terminal area, which really just feels like at this point is as like the day that they could open that, it would revolutionize the experience of getting to and from LAX.
Yes. The people mover, they say, is supposed to open in 2023, and then LA exit will be killed. The lot will no longer exist. So you have 3 years to take advantage of that. So for a long time, we haven't really talked about this, how LA County was going to build its first new freeway in 25 years.
Yeah.
This plan was a long time in the making. It was going to connect. It was going to basically be a bypass of the city of Los Angeles. And it was going to connect the 15 and the 5. The 15, you know the geography of this better than I do, but those are very far apart.
They're very far apart. We're talking about from the Castaic area, or even further north.
Apple Valley.
Yeah, through Apple Valley, through the Antelope Valley, basically going through like Palmdale and ending up in Hesperia, like very far apart.
63 miles.
From LA County to San Bernardino County. Mm-hmm. This is an old school freeway build in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of sensitive ecological and habitats with the explicit purpose of encouraging sprawl. This is the kind of thing LA used to do routinely. So we're saying like Palmdale and Lancaster are very rapidly growing areas, and also so is the Apple Valley. So we're going to build a giant like 4 or 5 lane in each direction freeway to connect these two cities and make sure that we're just going to see suburban tract homes pop up along this entire route. Something that Southern California used to excel at.
Yes.
And
but had taken a long break from.
Yeah. I mean, the last freeway that was built in Southern California before this. Last major freeway was the 105.
It was the 90, yes, in 93.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that took, what, 25 years because it was just untenable politically to build.
And when did the plans for this, they call this the High Desert Corridor, the 63-mile highway between the 5 and the 15, when did the plans for that really begin?
That is also, I mean, it's also been decades in the making. This is something that was in, that was receiving funding out of Measure R, which was passed by voters in 2008. I have to believe that the plans for this High Desert Corridor were probably dating back to at least the 90s. Mm-hmm. And this, again, like, this is an area where in between the two centers, population centers along this route, there really isn't much.
There are some neighborhoods. I remember a fun LA Times story from a few years ago about some houses that had basically been bought up by the county already.
Yep.
And they were sort of living in purgatory where they were like, eventually we are going to build a highway through your kitchen.
Yeah.
But you can stay here for now. Just like get ready to go.
This is like something that is really common when the state of California decides that it wants to build a freeway, which is, it's kind of bizarre, but like Caltrans was an enormous, and actually I think maybe still is, an enormous landlord in the San Gabriel Valley for decades because they had bought all these homes up where they were going to connect the two stub ends of the 710 freeway. And they were not a great landlord, according to people who live there, which is incredibly believable. I think I've said on this show before, my grandparents and the family house that my dad grew up in South LA, in Watts, was along the route of the 105. And it was like, if we ever actually build this freeway, we're going to knock down your house in order to build the 105, 110 interchange.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my grandparents had long since gone to Oakland by that point, but they kind of lived with that shadow over their home for like 15 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's that is something that happens. Like Caltrans will just like start buying up properties. This is interesting though, because it's from a standpoint of freeway building in California, it feels like a watershed moment, because if you can't build a new freeway in this specific part of Southern California, where like we are doing the same sort of development that we historically have done, and there's very little community for the resistance to sort of come out of, then you can't really build a freeway anywhere in Southern California. And I would say, great, like that's fantastic. But I think that should be accompanied by a more thorough come to Jesus moment for the State Department of Highways, like that maybe that time is really over.
So this one, the High Desert Corridor, was going to be an $8 billion highway. Bryn Lindblad of Climate Resolve spent a lot of time out there protesting the potential construction of this highway. But they started buying up land last June. They used Measure M money to start laying the groundwork for this thing. But as of this past week, the highway was shit can. It's a pretty big deal. It's a huge victory for Bryn and Climate Resolve. A huge amount of work went into this, and it demonstrates a positive trend in getting away from this kind of planning and like pursuing density and transit and other alternatives other than 8-lane highways through the middle of nowhere.
We actually, if you pay attention to the LA Times, then you every so often will see a story where one of LA's mountain lions is killed on a freeway or something like that. We have like really well documented evidence of the effect that freeways like this have on wild animal habitats. So like,
and I want to underscore the basis under which Climate Resolve sued, which is a big part of what killed this project, if not the main thing. They sued back in 2016 to stop it from happening based on that Caltrans did not account for the effects on global warming.
Yeah.
They said it would add 4 million additional miles being driven every single day.
Holy cow. That is incredible. And so the thing that blows my mind is that we're like, you know, we are still considering putting like these road projects through like they kind of just exist in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. Like they don't change people's behaviors. They don't affect the behaviors of wild animals. They don't affect the behavior of plant life. You know, like these are things that we know happen. And yet it's almost like our environmental laws have not kept up pace with our knowledge about the scope of these issues.
Yeah.
And I know Climate Resolve and other environmental activists have also been very good about pointing out that Metro was using money for public transportation for this project, which is almost counter to the very idea of public transportation.
Yes.
They did have another alternative.
Yes.
I'm not sure what the exact status of it is, but one of the things that they were talking about doing was dedicating specific right-of-way for the building of high-speed rail.
Along that same route, and as well as a bike route.
Interesting.
For at least part of it, which they are still planning on going ahead with, and they don't need to do additional environmental study on it.
Nice.
And so they like Measure M, they got $1.8 billion from Measure M to go towards the High Desert Corridor. And a lot of that money that was going to be going to freeway lanes is now opened up to high speed rail.
And that's fantastic.
So now it's very good.
Richard Branson's express Virgin train to Las Vegas just became that much more likely.
It did. A lot of good news this week, actually. We talked about, it was probably something like a year ago, the effort in Los Angeles to establish a public bank to avoid paying millions and millions and millions of dollars in fees to Wells Fargo and the other banks that have traditionally held Los Angeles's money. We would be able to keep it ourselves in our own bank. I mean, a big reason was to make money off of the sale of marijuana,
right?
Which you cannot put in a bank that is federally regulated right now. And so like a public bank would save the like taxpayers like tons and tons of money, and you could use it for things like affordable housing and transit projects and all that good stuff. The LA Times wrote a bizarre, horribly conceived editorial that I think played a not small role in killing it. The headline was, "A public bank would be risky, expensive, and a potential waste of tax dollars." They mostly criticized the wording.
They also called it the most ill-conceived charter amendment proposal in years.
Yes, it was. Oh, so yes, that's what it was. So that was the editorial from like May of this year. But last year, they said it was one of the most ill-conceived amendments in years.
That was last year. That was in September of last year.
The one you were talking about was last year. The one I was talking about was more recently.
Got it.
Then, 4 days ago, David Chu's bill to allow public banks to be formed in California was signed into law by Gavin Newsom. And now we are moving really, really fast. San Francisco is already moving ahead on setting up a public bank, and everything I'm hearing says that Herb Wesson, council president, who was one of the biggest champions in City Hall of a public bank, is going to start the process this week, potentially, as you're listening to this today.
Interesting.
They're going to make the announcement to start moving forward on this.
Wow. Okay. So, that kind of answers some of the questions that we had last year. Basically, does anyone in City Council actually care about this public banking thing? It seemed like no effort was extended at all on behalf of
which is
getting it passed.
Bizarre because a lot of power is consolidated in City Hall already. This would give them more.
Sure.
It effectively raises like the amount of money that they can spend, gives it more control over their finances. But it is a good thing, provided that the money goes toward affordable housing construction and things that will be beneficial to the community, which remains to be seen. We have no like arrangement in place over how the money would be spent, although some activists are working on that as well.
So just to like to recap for people who might not remember the exact specifics of the public banking measure last year, this was always going to be a multi-partite sort of legislative struggle. So the measure that was on the ballot last November was intended to get the approval of the public, which is still going to be required.
Yes.
Charter Amendment B failed. All that would have done would be to give City Council the authority to start and operate a public bank,
which it said in the city charter that they were effectively not able to do.
Yeah. I think they just don't expressly have that authority.
Right. Yes. And it was always going to be a big battle with the state because they were expressly forbidden, I believe, in like the state constitution from like cities could not set up their own public banks.
A lot of parts of this existed in a sort of gray area where they would have been tremendously open to legal challenge if they had decided to just go ahead and establish the charter for a public bank.
Mm-hmm.
So as always, city has to approve it. City council has to approve it. The public has to approve it and the state has to approve it.
Yeah.
Now we have the state getting rid of one of the largest roadblocks to the city public bank being established. and also to a, I believe, to a state public bank being established now mm-hmm. is also on the table. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so the city of Los Angeles can proceed if the city council is behind it. They can start the process of setting up a charter that would govern how that money would be spent, et cetera. And then they could return to the voters and ask for a vote of approval on the vote on the charter that they develop.
Yes, it did lose last year, but I think it's like pretty close. I remember
a big part of the LA Times's opposition to it was that the charter had not been developed in advance.
Right.
They spent a lot of time, like you said, it was bizarrely extreme in its denunciation of the concept of public banking. But basically, they said that city council should develop a plan and bring it to voters to then vote upon the specifics rather than giving them blanket authority to start a public bank. So potentially that could be what we see happening here.
Yeah, a lot of the barriers have fallen to this going forward. It's basically up to the voters at this point. I believe last time it got 42% of the vote went to yes. Mm-hmm. That one only required a simple majority for the charter amendment. I'm not sure if the new one, if they need to raise a lot of money for funding, if that would have to be a two-thirds vote.
No, I believe that. So for the purposes of giving the city council the authority to do this, I think that that would still be a simple majority vote.
Okay.
Because basically we are voting to change the financial authority powers of the city and not to raise money specifically. I think that that is the difference.
So big victories for a lot of people. The assembly members who wrote this bill, AB 57, were David Chu up in San Francisco and Miguel Santiago, who represents downtown LA. Herb Wesson, big victory for them, but mostly for the whole public bank movement that is pushing really hard for this to happen, led in LA by Trinity Tran. And last year, Chris Roth came on the show to talk about it. So that's very cool. A lot of good news this week. Happy show. Let's talk about a study that the Times did this week of the money going into the race for county supervisor in District 2. What neighborhoods does District 2 cover?
District 2 covers basically all of South LA, most of Central LA. So we're talking about the basin pretty much from, I want to say, like Koreatown area on southward, and it covers from that part of Central LA down to like about the Carson area, Inglewood, and all of that over to the east. It's pretty much all of South Central LA, and for a long time it has been considered basically the highest seat of Black political power in Los Angeles. Mark Ridley Thomas has been sitting there for the past three terms. He's now termed out. We did talk about the fact that Mark Ridley Thomas and Herb Wesson were basically considering swapping seats.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically what they have decided.
That's what they have decided to do. So yeah. Mark Ridley Thomas is running for Herb Wesson's seat, and Herb Wesson is running for Mark Ridley Thomas's seat. But we do also have a number of other people who are in this contest. Jan Perry, former city councilwoman and political adversary of Herb Wesson's.
Uh-huh. Also a former mayoral candidate.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And Holly Mitchell is the other big name contender who is in the state Senate currently, represents a district that is in many places overlapping with the second supervisorial district. So this has turned out to be a very, very big contest. And accordingly, we're seeing a lot of money flowing in here. The headline really is that Herb Wesson has raised a ton of money.
He has raised over $1 million, $1,119,445 as of the August 1st deadline.
Yeah.
So we can assume a lot more since then. So the max is $1,500. His average donation is $1,162.
Wow.
So he is not pursuing these like small time, like small dollar donors. He's getting lots of money from groups, the American Chemical Council, the Building Industry Association of Southern California, the California Association of Realtors, big unions representing food workers, plumbers, pipe fitters, and truck drivers. Like, he is using the political power that he has accumulated from like working with all these interest groups as president of the city council to raise cash.
And I think it's fair to say he is also using the political power that Mark Ridley Thomas has amassed.
They are sort of trading that political power in endorsing each other in each other's districts. So that makes him just an absolutely formidable candidate. That said, Holly Mitchell is a very well-liked political figure in this district. I think she is generally considered to be more, like, somewhat more progressive than Herb Wesson, although, like, these things are, like not necessarily broken down along those lines.
I think that it's interesting that what is most interesting to me is that Holly Mitchell is choosing this particular fight. I think that she is a really good state senator. And even in just this term, she has her bill to end discrimination against Section 8. Vouchers and housing, that rental discrimination is really important. That is an incredibly progressive piece of legislation that is hopefully coming out of this session. But it is interesting. Like, this is a relatively, I would say that the Black caucus of Democratic politicians is a relatively, if not close-knit, at least close quarters group. These people are all intimately familiar with one another. And it is interesting that given that we know that there is some, like, behind the scenes exchanging of seats that is going on, that Holly Mitchell thinks that she can possibly pull out a win here.
Yeah.
Which, you know, all the better for the health of the political process. But it does represent, as you said, a formidable challenge.
Yeah. Notably, she has raised a little over $500,000. A lot of that money, it was just transferred over from her state campaign committee. She had almost $400,000 pretty much left over from her last state race.
Right.
And so it might have, like, she has not raised a ton of money other than that. It could have just been the result on sitting on a lot of campaign cash that she felt like she could translate into a run. But yeah, also running is Jake Jeong, who has not raised a ton of money, but he is recently a very prominent figure in Koreatown. He led the fight to stop the shelter from getting built, the first Abridge Home shelter pushed by the mayor's office and by Herb Wesson for Koreatown. Jake Jeong rallied Koreatown to successfully push it into Westlake, and I believe was also involved in the neighborhood council fight that we also talked about on the show to stop Little Bangladesh from getting a neighborhood council named after them.
I think so. To the point that I raised earlier about Holly Mitchell's Section 8 discrimination, it will also be interesting to see how that plays out, because Herb Wesson also led a city effort. I think once it became apparent that the state was going to pass that anti-discriminatory action against Section 8 vouchers bill, that the city of LA also passed an anti-discrimination against Section 8 vouchers ordinance in the city of LA.
Nothing gets these candidates moving, these council members moving, like someone who's running against them doing something progressive.
Oh, we were going to do that.
Yes.
We were going to do that.
And we may have even done it first.
But it is this is an interesting race. The LA Times also had an article this past week about how gentrification has really been a central issue in Supervisorial District 2, that the notion of South LA as one of the last historic Black enclaves in not just LA, but the entire state of California, something that is always just kind of staggering for me when I both say it and think about it. But yeah, so you have one of these few remaining pockets where there actually is a large and thriving Black community, but it has been subjected to a lot of disrupting forces over the years, from mass incarceration to more recently gentrification of neighborhoods that were previously completely disinvested in and disregarded by the state and private actors. So it is something now that candidates are being asked to speak about when they go to town halls and things like that. How would they address the fragility of the Black communities in South LA? And one of the interesting points that's brought up a lot in this week's article is SB 50 is still on people's minds as candidates are out making early rounds before the March primary. They're getting asked a lot about what their stance would be on SB 50. Herb Wesson, of course, led a unanimous vote against SB 50 and its predecessor, SB 827. That this bill being, again, the one that would upzone particular parcels near transit. It would make it so that more dense housing could be built. In later iterations of the bill, it would also allow the subdivision of single family homes into fourplex units. And a lot of people in South LA, despite the fact that SB 50 would exempt for a certain number of years as currently written, communities like those in South LA from the stipulations that it contains. A lot of people are very worried about the effect that this would have on South LA.
Yeah.
Herb Wesson on the record, as I said, Jan Perry also on the record against Holly Mitchell, apparently, according to this article, has not come down firmly one way or the other. I think it's interesting to note that SB 329, the Section 8 discrimination bill that she had, she co-authored with Scott Wiener, who was the author of SB 50. So clearly she has a working relationship with Scott Wiener's office. I would hazard a guess that she is probably considerably more favorable to the intent and the general cast of that legislation than is a Herb Wesson. But it doesn't seem like she wants to say that.
No.
Which is interesting.
I can say, too, it's not just this race. It's basically every race, the one that I've been volunteering with, Nithya Raman's in CD4. Every event someone asks about SB 50, every conversation with like neighborhood groups, this is still something that people are extremely, extremely focused on.
Yeah.
Not just from a gentrification standpoint, people in single family neighborhoods who don't want apartments near them, like everyone is still really freaking out about it. I think at this point it has very low odds of going forward if it even gets picked up again.
Does not look good.
Getting closer to elections. I mean, they talked about picking it back up in January, which is right before the March primary. I am not sure a lot of candidates will want to hitch their wagon to this necessarily. All of it, by the way, in these city and council races is totally moot. None of them running for this office, if they win, will ever have any say over SB 50 whatsoever.
Right.
And the real question should be, what would they do instead? They have control over housing, especially at the city level.
Yep.
So like, what would you, if not SB 50, what are you going to do? Like, do you think there needs to be more housing? What kind of housing do you think there should be? And how are you going to get it built if so?
I mean, the cowardice of the LA City Council, notwithstanding, I'm sure if SB 50 were passed, we would get something that was like legalizing fourplexes throughout the city the next day or whatever.
Yeah, sure. Which, by the way, it would be cool.
Which would be totally within their power, right? Yeah, yes. I agree with you that they could easily, they could act in a way that would, you know, like suggest that they were politically active.
Yeah. Or do the thing we talked about, like, and in the process of voting no on SB 50, they were saying that, like, lots of them said, we should build more housing, but it should have higher affordability requirements. We should make sure that lower income people can live in these, in the new construction. Totally valid criticism, unless you are the person who has the power to do this and is, for some reason, not acting on that.
I really don't think that it looks good for SB 50 that we're in October now. Mm-hmm. This is we've talked about the May massacre of housing legislation, where almost every progressive piece of housing legislation went down, except for there were a few key ones that survived. The Just Cause eviction was revived a little bit as part of the rent cap legislation, the anti-rent gouging legislation that did make it. So that was good. SB 50 didn't even make it to May. Mm-hmm. It was the first one on the chopping block.
Yeah.
So we're talking about half a year gone, and this is still the top priority for a lot of voters.
Yeah.
Which people were saying at the time, if it can't pass in 2019, it doesn't have a whisper of a chance of passing in 2020, when so many people are going to, as you said, have to hitch their reelection campaign to what their vote is going to be on this. You have to wonder if it's worth it at this point to start parceling out the individual elements that were contained in SB 50.
Yeah, part of which was the fourplex thing. Eventually it got...
Agree. That, I think, is ripe to be spun off to its own separate thing and like let people kind of decide whether or not they would vote to support it or not.
Because something that has happened since SB 50 got shelved that should be reshaping the conversation is the housing that we are now required to build by the state has gone way, way up.
Yep.
So unless we...
Has to be put somewhere, right?
Yeah. So like now the question is less about should we do it, but how are we going to?
Yeah.
I want to highlight one more thing in this article about County District 2. They have a list of which neighborhoods gave the most.
Yeah.
And so I'm just going to go from top to bottom. And number one is downtown, part of which is in County District 2. Number two is Koreatown, which is fully in County District 2. Number three is Beverly Hills. It's not in the district at all. Number four, Brentwood. Not there. Number five, Long Beach. Not even close. Number six, Santa Monica.
Yeah.
No. Westwood. No. Encino. No. Pasadena. No. And then finally, you get to Sawtelle. Part of Sawtelle is in
county you district.
So like the power of the county board of supervisors is such that they are making friends in high places all over the place. And there are definitely deep pocketed interests who are going to be watching this race closely and returning favors, et cetera. So that this is going to be a very, this is going to be a spendy race.
I'll say this, at least all these neighborhoods are in LA County.
Right.
When I've been looking at a lot of donations for city candidates, and when it comes to incumbents, less than half of their donations in a lot of cases are even in the city of LA.
Yeah.
Forget their district. The money comes from like the same places, Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, Long Beach, Pasadena. Like places that in the city you don't even represent, but this is where the power brokers are. This is where the money comes from for all of these races. Let's stick with the county supervisors for one more little story that came out just as we were recording last week. LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger, who represents District 5, the one, the big Antelope Valley, like Palmdale.
Everything North County. Yes. Basically all of the valleys that you can think of, San Gabriel, San Fernando, Santa Clarita, everywhere that cops live.
It's very big.
Yeah, it's huge.
And that might explain why she chooses to navigate the district in a helicopter that costs $9,500 an hour.
Shocking.
Is primarily used for firefighting and is environmentally devastating.
Yeah.
But you love to, I mean, you don't have the high desert corridor anymore.
You love to see her like spokespeople trying to spin this into what an attentive supervisor Catherine Barger is. Well, you really love it. I mean, it's just like, well, would you rather her not go to these meetings? She's just trying to do her job.
She went to induct the newest board members of the Antelope Valley East Kern Water Agency. That cost $17,000. This was all reported by the LA Daily News. That cost $17,000. She didn't have to go induct those people. It was nice of her to show up.
Kern County? Kern Valley.
The Antelope Valley East Kern Water Agency.
Ah, okay.
It must overlap with Kern a little bit. All of her flights cost at least $200,000, but it was impossible to confirm that figure because of spotty record keeping.
Oof.
Shocking again.
This is honestly, besides being really a waste of resources and, you know, like you really love it when LA Times editorial endorsements come out and they tell you that it's okay to vote for a Republican because they'll be financially sensible. You always are waiting for something like this to come out, but it is also an opportunity for me to bang my favorite drum, which is that there are not enough county supervisors.
The
district is enormous, but that doesn't mean she should be flying from here to there in her own private helicopter. It means that the district should be smaller. Like the representation, each county supervisor, of course, there are five of them in a district of 10 million people. Some quick maths, that is 2 million people per supervisor, which is a lot of people, bigger than most states. So like the amount of representation that you're getting from your county administrator is oftentimes negligible, and that is something that we should work to change. San Francisco has 15. San Francisco's tiny,
much smaller.
San Francisco's
county.
Tiny. Yes. 49 square miles.
Is there any body, would you say, other than like certain neighborhood councils, that has too many people?
Oh no, wait, that has too many people.
LAUSD has way too few.
No.
City has way too few.
In almost all regards, LA County and LA City are the least represented people in the entire country in almost all regards. So we have California's state legislators. They represent more people per legislator than anyone aside from the actual House of Representatives.
Oh my God.
So then you have the city and county, where, of course, city council members represent like 400,000 people. And then you have the county, where 2 million people per supervisor. It is a major problem, and it's one that would be easily addressed if there were any actual willpower to do it.
This is the Black Hawk, by the way. These are the firefighting version of, they're called Firehawks because they're firefighting Black Hawks. And this article was by Jason Henry, who also gave us that really fun story about City of Industry a few weeks ago. Thank you, Jason. And thank you for listening to LA Podcast. We will be back with our friend Alyssa Walker next week. And we'll see you then. Bye-bye. LA Podcast.